I'd like to talk a little bit about time travel. You know, actually, antimatter may repel gravity. And when you repel gravity, according to Einstein, time and space are affected by gravity. So if you do defeat gravity, you're also messing with time and space. And in fact, in particle physics, the positron, which is like the opposite of an electron, is essentially the opposite in several ways. It has a different charge. It also a different parity, which means it's like a mirror image, but on three axes, you know, up, down, left and right, backwards and forwards. And it also could travel backwards in time. A positron could be the exact opposite of electron traveling back in time. Now, we live in a universe that's mostly matter, because when matter and antimatter meet, they destroy each other. But there may be another universe repelled from our universe, possibly in the area between Hydra and Centaurus. But let's get back to time travel on our own planet. Apparently, during World War II, some people were developing anti-gravity devices.
Many believe UFOs come from outer space. But there's another theory, that what we now call UFOs got their start in World War II, inside Hitler's Germany. A new investigation reveals that Nazi engineers were working on disc-shaped craft, vertical takeoff, and advanced propulsion systems. After the war, the U.S. military secretly took the designs back to the States, along with thousands of German scientists and engineers. 2 years later, in 1947, the first wave of UFO sightings occurs across the United States, and then around the world. UFOs be secret U.S. aircraft developed from captured German designs? To find an answer, we have to look at some of the most compelling UFO sightings, those witnessed by professional pilots trained in aerial observation. The first major pilot reports date back to the final months of World War II. Declassified British and American documents revealed that in the skies over Germany, Allied pilots witnessed unusual flying objects.
The crews were seeing strange objects that they couldn't identify. As they engaged them or tried to engage them, they weren't acting normal like conventional aircraft.
The men nicknamed the objects Foo Fighters after a popular comic book character. But there was nothing funny about these encounters. Researcher Keith Chester has interviewed 12 Foo Fighter witnesses and analyzed dozens of Allied pilot reports.
Some of the pilots actually thought that they were traveling at speeds in excess of thousands of miles per hour, the way they shot straight up in the air or away from them. Most of the veterans that I've talked with have since passed away, except for one. And his name is Major Harold Augsburger. He was the commanding officer of the 415th.
I saw a light off the right wing. We couldn't tell how close it was, but it was following along. Whatever we turned, it turned. My radar operator let the orders. He says, looks like a light to me, but I don't have any airplane on my radar system. So we made a turn to go over to see what it was. And when we got closer to it, all of a sudden the explosion blew it up just like a rocket.
At first, the crews keep quiet about the sightings.
It was a real secret thing. Nobody talks about it at all.
The Foo Fighter reports make their way up the U.S. Army chain of command. Many assume they are German secret weapons.
Some scientists from Washington, D.C. showed up in France to the unit to investigate what this was. and they had no answers, and they told the men just to keep it quiet.
Reports soon leak out, and major newspapers print stories about the mysterious objects. Fireballs are chasing American bombers. The Allies have good reason to fear any new German weapons. Advanced V-1 and V-2 rockets are already raining down on England. Nazi jet fighters are shooting down Allied bombers. And Hitler speaks about new wonder weapons that he is developing to win the war for Germany. If the Foo Fighters chasing Allied airplanes are Nazi secret weapons, they would be coming from secret German facilities 20,000 feet below in a series of top secret Nazi bunkers. Since the summer of 1944, the German war machine had been moving underground to escape heavy Allied bombing. Across Poland, Austria, and Czechoslovakia, vast complexes were dug out by slave labor. These facilities housed munitions factories and jet engine plants. They also hid the work of Hitler's scientists, men ordered by Hitler to build him a war-winning weapon. Hans von Oheim's revolutionary jet engines propelled fighters through the skies. The Horton brothers built space-age flying wings. Alexander Lippisch worked on vertical takeoff craft. At Peenemünde, legendary rocket engineer Wernher von Braun built the first ballistic missiles. And most radical of all, men like Victor Schauberger explored new sources of propulsion.
It boggles the mind to try to grasp what these guys were thinking, because it is so totally alien. And that allowed them to go into areas that are completely beyond the Western paradigm, beyond what Western science says, this is what science is. And the Nazis said, this is what science is.
This huge operation was under the command of SS General Dr. Hans Kammler. An engineer by trade, Kammler redesigned the ovens at Auschwitz for greater efficiency. In 1943, he led the destruction of the Warsaw Ghetto. And then in 1944, he took command of the entire Nazi secret weapons program. Working out of the Škoda factory in Pilsen, Czechoslovakia, Kammler and a hand-picked think tank brainstormed and approved advanced weapons designs. Some were so radical, only a handful of people knew the full details.
The Germans worked on various, unconventional aerial systems or weapons to build some objects that were more or less circular. Vertical takeoff and landing crafts, for example.
Vertical takeoff was a top priority for Kammler's team. Germany's runways were being bombed out of existence. They needed a warbird that wasn't reliant on 800 feet of tarmac. One project had that potential. Die Glocke, the bell. Igor Witkowski is a Polish aerospace historian. He has researched the bell for over 20 years. His investigations have concluded that the device was tested in an underground facility called the Wenceslas Mine.
The external appearance of the bell was such that it was a ceramic cover, bell-shaped, which housed a kind of a core or axis around which rotated two cylinders around the same axis in opposite directions. And after connecting to high voltage current, the cylinders started spinning in opposite directions.
Witkowski thinks the Germans were trying to create an electrically charged vortex. Just like a tornado, the suction could conceivably lift objects vertically.
Everything suggests mathematical calculations, for example, that it could have been an effective way to master gravity.
Were the Nazis on the verge of a major propulsion breakthrough? In April 1945, the Allies had nearly overrun Hitler's forces, and it was time for the scientists and engineers to get out of Germany. The question was, where would they go? and what would happen to their designs? Could a UFO crash 20 years later in Pennsylvania provide an answer? UFOs are reported in our airspace.
When I got over the village, and it was gone out of sight.
Are UFOs alien vehicles, or is there a more terrestrial explanation? Captured documents revealed that during World War II, the Nazis worked on radical aviation designs and vertical takeoff. One project, the Bell, may have shown promise. At the end of the war, it vanished. 20 years later, an unusual event occurs in Pennsylvania. December 9th, 1965, 4:30 p.m. Eyewitnesses report a UFO crash in a wooded area just outside Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. Their reports describe something that looks like an acorn. One witness even says the object looks like a bell. Stan Gordon is a local investigator and expert on the Kecksburg incident.
It's approximately 10 to 12 feet or more in length, about 8 to 10 feet in diameter, but it's one solid piece of metal, kind of an unusual off-gold, bronze, copper color.
The object has one other highly distinctive feature.
On the bottom, one witness called it the bumper area, the raised up area of the acorn. There's these unusual markings that raised up off of that surface.
At the crash site in the woods, the Kecksburg residents soon find they've outstayed their welcome.
They're not there very long when two men in trench coats come down out of the woods, very stern, and they tell them, get out of the area, this area is now quarantined. And he said, right behind these men are soldiers coming down, military people.
Eyewitnesses later report seeing the object on a military vehicle speeding out of town. Where were they taking it? Stan Gordon thinks it went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, 250 miles west in Ohio. According to Gordon, just 2 days after the Kecksburg incident, the base makes an unusual request for ceramic bricks from a local foundry.
They ordered a large supply, 6,500 of a special type of brick. It was double glazed engineer brick. And that order was to be sent to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
The delivery truck driver, Myron, later gives an interview where he claims he saw a bell-shaped object in a hangar.
When I walked in the building and seen the bell shape there and they was working on it, one to do with this brick is to enclose it. They was going to entomb it.
But why ceramic bricks? Ceramic is used for electrical and heat insulation. Was the Air Force trying to somehow shield the object? Could its physical similarity to the Nazi bell be more than just a coincidence? And could the ceramic bricks provide a further link between the two objects? The Kecksburg craft was reportedly encased in ceramic bricks. According to Polish aerospace journalist Igor Witkowski, the Nazi bell was also shielded by a ceramic casing. Witkowski thinks the bell was tested here, at a mysterious structure in Poland called the Henge.
The Henge itself stands in a pool of water. And the pool itself was covered with ceramic tiles.
The Nazi bell had another reported feature, distinctive markings.
The Nazis had this bizarre religious science, which included a lot of occultism. And they used occult symbols. And the bell was supposedly covered in occult symbols.
The raised up area of the acorn. There's these unusual markings.
The evidence is compelling, but circumstantial. Both the bell and the Kecksburg craft needed ceramic. Physically, they appear similar, and both display unusual symbols. The question is, if the Kecksburg object was a Nazi bell, How did it end up in America 20 years later? To answer that question, it's necessary to go back to Germany and the end of World War II. In April 1945, Hitler orders the deaths of 62 scientists working on the Bell Project. Concentration camp prisoners working on the secret underground projects are also executed. These mass killings are overseen by the SS general in charge of Hitler's secret weapons projects, Dr. Hans Kammler.
The entrances to the tunnels were blown up, and all the prisoners of the concentration camps, which knew something, anything about the production or the purpose, was closed inside, and so the mystery of this undertaking was sealed off effectively.
Hitler trusts Kammler to wipe out any traces of the Nazis' secret projects. But what the Führer doesn't know is that Kammler is getting ready to turn sides. In 1981, Hitler's former Minister of Armaments and War, Albert Speer, confessed that Kammler had told him he was planning to take all his secrets to the Americans in return for immunity. Did Kammler change sides? In April 1945, the man who had access to the Horton Flying Wing, who'd overseen von Oheim's jet revolution, von Braun's ballistic missiles, Schauberger's saucer, and the mysterious Bell, leaves his base in Pilsen and vanishes forever.
We actually don't know what happened to Hans Kammler at the end of the war. He has just disappeared. Nobody has been found.
Six different reports of his death were recorded. At the Nuremberg trials, he was barely mentioned, even though he had been directly responsible for the destruction of the Warsaw Ghetto and designing ovens at Auschwitz. Other SS officers that were dead or missing were tried in their absence. Why not Kammler? Was it an oversight by the Allies, or did Kammler make good on his plan to hand over his secrets to the United States?
Kammler would have been a trump card, for example, for the Russians or for the Americans as such an expert.
If he did go to America, he joined a roll call of Germany's most brilliant minds. Under a secret program called Operation Paperclip, the U.S. military swept up and transported Nazi engineers and scientists back to the States.
The American public knew about a few of the paperclip Nazis. Wernher von Braun was the poster child for the program. Most people who had heard of Project Paperclip or bringing the Nazi scientists to the U.S. Figured it was only a few hundred of them.
Declassified documents held at the National Archives indicate the actual number of scientists was in the thousands. Von Oheim, Germany's jet pioneer, went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Alexander Lippisch, an expert in vertical takeoff, went to White Sands, New Mexico. With them came prototypes like the Horton Brothers Flying Wing and a mountain of documents. By 1946, Nazi Germany had been stripped bare. 1 year later, with Nazi scientists settled all over America, the first wave of UFO sightings begins.
That looks about what it was, Jay.
Is it a coincidence? Or does a closer investigation of the most famous UFO sighting at Roswell, New Mexico, reveal a new and very dark secret? June 1947. Kenneth Arnold, a 42-year-old pilot, makes the first widely reported UFO sighting in the United States. Flying over Washington State, he sees a formation of crescent-shaped craft displaying unusual flight characteristics. Dr. Bruce McAbee is an optical physicist who has investigated the Arnold case.
There were no wings, he could see no wings, no engines, no vertical stabilizers or anything that was normal, but he assumed it was some sort of a new aircraft.
Arnold's description of their movement results in the first use of the term flying saucer. Just 2 weeks later, America experiences the most famous UFO event of all time. July 1947, an object crashes near Roswell Army Airfield in New Mexico. After investigating the crash site, the Air Force puts out a sensational press release.
The Roswell Army Air Base issued a press release saying that they had a flying saucer that had crashed in the desert.
Just a few hours after the initial press release, the Air Force did a 180, telling the press that the crashed object was a weather balloon. An innocent mistake or deliberate misinformation?
From the beginning, they had something they did not want the public to know.
If they weren't hiding a crashed alien spacecraft at Roswell, what were they hiding? Does further investigation reveal a link to captured Nazi technology?
For me, the most compelling link between the Roswell event and the Nazis is the shape of the aircraft. The aircraft apparently was a flying wing, and it's well established the Nazis were working on a flying wing.
The Roswell crash happened within flying distance of White Sands, the Air Force base where the Horton brothers' Nazi flying wing was first taken. Roswell was just 2 weeks after Kenneth Arnold had seen the world's first widely reported UFO. Is this what the Air Force was trying to cover up? An American-built flying wing prototype based on Nazi technology. After Roswell, UFO sightings go through the roof, peaking in the 50s.
They're seeing flying saucers everywhere. Flocks of fantastic discs flying through the air. Is there something to it?
There were tens of thousands of sightings. It's well documented now that there was virtually some sort of air war over America in 1952.
The public is convinced that an alien invasion has begun. Even President Truman gets in on the act.
There's always things like that going on. Flying saucers, you know.
By the late 50s, popular culture is reinforcing the message. UFOs mean aliens. Flying saucers are from outer space. In 1952, the U.S. Air Force establishes Project Blue Book, an official task force based at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Project Blue Book collects and evaluates UFO reports. An analysis of these eyewitness sightings shows that Roswell wasn't the only UFO incident happening close to America's most secret bases.
There were large numbers of sightings around hotspots. Hotspots as super secret, super sensitive military bases. Often bases where German scientists had been moved to after the war as paperclip.
Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was one of these hotspots. Initial newspaper reports claim this is where the Roswell wreckage was taken. Project Blue Book had its headquarters here. In 1965, the Kecksburg object was reportedly seen inside one of its hangars. And it was home to some of Nazi Germany's most brilliant scientists. Dr. Paul Ziss is a retired aeronautical engineer. He worked with German Project Paperclip scientists at Wright-Patterson in the late 1950s.
I worked with about seven of them. There were probably about 40 of them at Wright-Patterson. First of all, they were loyal Germans, and they wanted Germany to win, and I don't find anything wrong with that. And they became loyal Americans when they came over here.
Loyal enough to keep quiet about Germany's most secret weapons programs? What did the Project Paperclip scientists know about radical gravity theories and flying saucers? Paul Ziss's boss, Dr. Wilhelm Nachtstedt, knew something.
Doc would say there were some guys who had some wild ideas about levitating things, but he was not really interested in it.
But the U.S. military was. In the late 1950s, top secret testing began at Wright-Patterson on a disc-shaped or lenticular aircraft.
They may have found something in Germany that had a lenticular shape that they were trying to reproduce.
The U.S. Air Force's first acknowledged flying saucer program is about to take off.
Through the 1950s, UFO reports increase across the United States. Were these UFOs alien vehicles from another planet? Or is there a human explanation? Government documents declassified in 1995 show that in the 1950s, the U.S. Air Force invested $5 million in a top-secret program known as Project Silverbug, run out of the Avro Canadian Company in Toronto. The project centered on a radical new craft, the Avro car. Bill Zook is a Canadian aviation historian.
The Avro car was a proof-of-concept vehicle. It was intended to show the way that a design of a complete flying disc would work.
Declassified Silverbug documents project a top speed of Mach 3 and a maximum ceiling of 80,000 feet. It would take off vertically using the Coanda effect. In the 1930s, Henry Coanda showed that a flow of air around a curved surface will follow the contour to create lift. The Avro car would achieve the Coanda effect by using three engines to power a central fan. The downdraft would follow the curved surface and launch the craft into the sky. British engineering genius John Frost was the brains behind the project. Frost openly admitted that his inspiration had come directly from World War II German research.
In 1953, he sat through a debriefing session with a German engineer who'd claimed that there was some testing of a flying disc in a test facility outside of Prague in the Second World War.
This confirmation of German saucer tests wasn't the only link between the Avro car and Nazi Germany. One of the key advisors to the project was Alexander Lippisch, a Project Paperclip engineer. During World War II, he had worked alongside other Nazi scientists on vertical takeoff.
What John Frost was doing was basically mining some of the information that Lippisch could provide.
Frost was leaning heavily on German know-how. What did he know about their designs that convinced him the Avro car would work? Could it have anything to do with a top-secret Nazi project called the Repulsine? Built by Austrian engineer Victor Schauberger, it bears more than a passing resemblance to Frost's Avro car. Jörg Schauberger is Victor Schauberger's grandson. He owns an original unpowered model of the Repulsine device.
And here is the device Victor Schauberger is very well known for when it comes to suction, anti-gravity, levitation, energy. It's the so-called Repulsine.
Schauberger conducts his work at the Mauthausen concentration camp. Like the Avro car, Schauberger's Repulsine operates on the Coanda effect. According to Jörg Schauberger, his grandfather's initial tests astonished the whole team.
By accident, this device flew to the ceiling of the workshop. Victor thought there is some levitational force within the machine. And this is anti-gravity working.
But in 1944, just as Schauberger and his team are making progress, the SS orders him to head east.
He writes one day he has to go to a secret facility somewhere in Poland. And then we don't have any reports from him for many weeks.
Poland, home of the Bell, another Nazi project focused on vortices and anti-gravity. Was Schauberger brought in to help their design team? At the war's end, Schauberger's designs and prototypes are seized by the Allies.
Victor said after the war that the US have things stolen from him that were very important for his work.
All the working models of the Repulsine vanish. A few years later, As the first flying saucer reports flood the United States, Victor Schauberger is stunned.
He himself tells journalists or people who listen to him, I was the one who built the first flying saucer. So maybe I am the father of the UFOs.
Are Victor Schauberger's confiscated designs helping the U.S. build flying saucers? If so, they don't appear to help John Frost. There's nothing stunning about the results of Project Silverbug. In tests, the Avro car proves it can take off vertically, but its performance is limited by a lack of power.
In order to actually get off the ground, it had to be powered almost to full thrust, and that would just be enough to rise it into the air at about 3 feet height. And that altitude, then it could be pushed forward to about the speed of a moving car, maybe 60 kilometers an hour.
Frost proved the aerodynamic theories of disc flight could work. What he lacked was more time and money to find the power the craft needed. In 1961, the Air Force canceled Project Silverbug, and all rights to the Avro car reverted to the Department of Defense. It looked like the end of the road for man-made saucers. Or was it? Just 4 years later, in 1965, a bell-shaped object crashes in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. The U.S. military and government agencies are immediately on the scene. Eyewitnesses report that the craft is rushed to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the same place the Avro car was being tested just years before. Was the Kecksburg crash part of a secret U.S. project to continue development on flying saucers? Did it crash because, like the Avro car, it was underpowered and unstable? If the U.S. military was conducting tests with working flying saucers, they would have to be kept hidden. People would have to be silenced. Impossible? One fact is undisputed. It's been done before in the U.S. military's black projects at a place called Area 51. The investigation into a Nazi UFO conspiracy raises as many new questions as answers. Secret Project Silverbug documents, declassified in 1995, show the U.S. Air Force invested in the development of a supersonic, high-altitude flying saucer. The design is influenced by Second World War German designs and aeronautical engineers. But the Avro car, the version of the saucer made public, doesn't achieve its original design specifications. In 1961, the project is canceled. 5 years later, a UFO crashes in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. The U.S. military restricts all access to the scene. Eyewitness statements suggest that the object they recover is remarkably similar to a Nazi craft called the Bell. Did the U.S. military cover up a continuing saucer program based on captured Nazi technology? And if so, could the U.S. government keep it secret to this day?
It would never surprise me at all if a program back in the 1950s or the 1960s was still so secret that its existence wasn't even hinted at.
If the Air Force did continue their saucer program, there is a place they could hide it. Groom Lake in the Nevada desert, also known as Area 51. The U.S. Air Force's legendary testing range for top secret aviation prototypes. Covering over 2,000 square miles, it's remote, desolate, and very well protected.
If you get too near Area 51, you're going to see signs, and at the bottom they say in red, very ominous words, use of deadly force authorized.
Bill Sweetman knows Area 51. As a former aviation journalist for Jane's Defense magazine, he spent his life investigating black projects. These projects are funded by Congress, but the Department of Defense does not acknowledge their existence.
What that means is that the existence of the program itself is a secret. Its function, its purpose, its existence itself
is not disclosed. The conservative estimate is that across the services and the intelligence community, we're looking at least $40 to $45 billion per year.
The secrecy surrounding Area 51 and the restrictions on employees maintain a wall of silence.
People who work in those programs are genuinely fearful that if they do become indiscreet, that they will be looking at a very, very long period of jail time at the very best.
Fear by silence. In 1975, work begins on the Super Black Stealth Program, the development of fighters invisible to enemy radar. The project management is run out of a secure facility at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Test flying is carried out at night.
Even the commander of Wright-Patterson didn't know what was going on.
For 13 years, the project was kept secret until 1988, when the world got its first look at the incredible F-117. Then came the blackest project of them all. The Northrop B-2 stealth bomber. Jack Northrop had long been fascinated with the idea of a flying wing, realizing the best way to reduce drag was to remove the tail and fuselage. Nazi engineers had proved it was possible in a jet with the Horton H-9.
There was actually one example of that aircraft which never flew, but survived and was captured by the U.S. and it was stored at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
When the B-2 bomber was first revealed to the public in 1988, it bore a striking resemblance to the German H-9 flying wing and Kenneth Arnold's famous UFO sighting. Were they all part of a 50-year design process? A design process that resulted in man-made craft the public could easily mistake for UFOs? What's certain is that if these experimental craft were seen or crashed, you'd need to disinform the public immediately. That meant telling people that they weren't seeing top-secret U.S. planes. That meant suggesting these sightings were extraterrestrial, alien, from another planet.
The Air Force consciously manipulated the UFO myth in order to provide cover for the black programs that it was developing.
In 1997, the CIA admitted an active involvement in UFO disinformation.
Every time you start talking about Area 51, somebody starts talking about UFOs and small gray aliens. If that is indeed the result of a deliberate disinformation attempt, I would love to meet the person responsible and shake his hand, because it was a really, really good one.
So what is happening at Area 51? It still employs thousands of people. Even though the last known aircraft tested there, Tacit Blue, was greenlit in 1976.
So we have 25, 30 years of black programs, hundreds of billions of dollars that we know nothing about.
The Horton H-9, Stealth, the F-117, the B-2. The U.S. military has successfully hidden its top secret projects, including any evidence of flying saucers. But what about other countries, other sightings? Is there an explanation for the incredible UFO reports outside of the United States? An explanation that may also lead to Nazi engineers? Of all the conspiracies surrounding Nazi UFOs, the most controversial is the idea that some Nazis escaped the fall of Germany along with advanced saucer prototypes. Evidence clearly shows that a number of prominent SS officers did escape the Allies and went underground.
In extreme southern Latin America, particularly Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, there are to this day huge German reservations.
One man who never surfaced again was General Hans Kammler, the head of Germany's World War II secret weapons program. If anyone knew the truth about saucer technology, it was him. On April 17, 1945, Kammler sent his last telegram. In it, he refuses a request from the head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, for a Junkers truck. Why would Himmler want a truck? Why would Kammler turn his boss down? Some experts believe truck was the code name for the massive six-engined Ju-390, a plane capable of flying 6,000 miles nonstop. Only two were built, and Kammler had one. After the war, his Ju-390 was never found. Did Kammler use this massive transporter to escape? If he did, where was he going, and what was he taking? In 1945, a sudden surge of UFO sightings occurred in South America. Had the Nazi engineers found a new base?
There were thousands of sightings in the years immediately following the war, much more so than in North America, which indicates the possibility that the Nazis flew to South America and continued operating their craft from their bases there.
The president of Argentina, Juan Perón, approved 1,000 passports for Nazi scientists and engineers. War criminals Klaus Barbie and Adolf Eichmann were both traced to South America. Reimer Horton, Nazi flying wing pioneer, moved to Argentina in 1948. Ever since, the trail of UFO sightings has grown throughout South America, just as it has in the United States. The Nazi UFO conspiracy is complex, compelling, and circumstantial. In 1944, Allied pilots see UFOs over Germany. Deep underground, the Nazis are building top-secret airframes and propulsion systems. At the war's end, the SS general in charge vanishes without a trace. His scientists, their research, and prototypes are captured by the U.S. military and shipped to the States. 2 years later, the first wave of UFO sightings occurs across America. Are these, in fact, U.S. prototypes of a captured Nazi H-9 flying wing? In the late 50s, the U.S. Air Force funds the Avro car, a flying saucer that looked like a Nazi secret project called the Repulse. And in 1965, a UFO crashes in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. It is reportedly bell-shaped and covered with distinctive markings, just like a radical Nazi device that may have been built at the end of the war. It's a trail of evidence that leads right to the very heart of the UFO conspiracy. Did the Nazis build successful saucer prototypes? Did the U.S. government and other nations develop them in secret? Are all these sightings human-engineered craft? Will governments or the military ever reveal the truth behind the presence of UFOs in our airspace?
It would be a major blow against the credibility of the U.S. government to suddenly have to admit that flying saucers are real. People often ask me, well, when do you think the government is going to own up to the fact? And I say, I don't think it ever will.
The Nazi UFO conspiracy continues.
FreakRadio.org. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. I said we were going to talk about time travel. Now, apparently the Nazis didn't really finish their UFO until they got to Argentina, where they perfected it. And we saw that in that they appear 20 years later, one of the Bell craft. As I was saying earlier, there is time travel involved in anti-gravity. And there's actually, you know, the Nazis, when they were doing their research on it, they were researching ancient texts from around the world, specifically in India. India has quite a few stories about aerial combat in distance past. And they talked about using mercury. And that is also what the Nazis were using in those two counter-rotating cylinders at the bottom, conducting fluid that can create vortexes. Might have been modification of Mercury, but it is essentially, they give it another code name. Now, it looks like they crashed a lot. It was kind of hard to control. Perhaps they went back to 10,500 BC by accident and got stuck there. There is evidence, Joseph Campbell had evidence of a swastika on a mammoth tusk from around 10,000 BC. As I said, there was those ancient texts from India. They were probably copied from earlier documents. So in a sense, the Nazis got their technology from themselves. It was like a time loop. Now, what would they have done with this? First off, being Nazis, they would have tried to win World War II. They would have gone back and messed around with the timeline. Do we see any evidence of this? Well, I was recently reading about Otto Skorzeny's rescue of Mussolini towards the end of the war. He got incredibly lucky. He went in the wrong door. It turned out to be the communications equipment. He knocked that out. I mean, it was the best door to go through. That's 50-50. That could have been just been luck. But he also, they used gliders, and when they were taking off, there was going to be two gliders where people with guns were going to land first and take the area. That would not have worked. He actually kind of fooled the Italians by bringing an Italian general with him. Had there been firing, the Nazis would have been outnumbered at that point, and it would have failed. That was incredibly lucky, because on takeoff, the two gliders with those commandos in it both hit potholes or something on the runway and were destroyed. The odds on that got to be in the thousands to one. That's usually the fog of war works against you. Here was working to his benefit. And Otto Skorzeny was the... he was in charge of the money in Argentina that the Nazis brought over. So probably, you know, he would have got special consideration. So in the end, he looked like a hero, but the rescue of Mussolini was of absolutely no significance to the end of the war. Basically, the Nazis were up against the grandfather paradox. They didn't complete the UFO until... they lost a war in Argentina, so there was no way they could ever win that war. They probably tried several times. And when I say they went back in time, probably it wasn't Nazis from our timeline. Time is just the fourth dimension. The fifth dimension is alternate timelines. So there's a probability, quantum probability, that other timelines will have similar events nearby. So, you know, Nazis on several timelines developed them. The Philadelphia experiment was our foray into this kind of science. If it happened or not, there seems to be less evidence, but it could conceivably have happened. Oppenheimer was working on a project to create invisibility for a ship, and they were going to use the magnetic Zeeman effect. By the way, magnetism is heavily involved in this. It's part of the unified field theory, where all the different forces, the five different forces, nuclear, weak, electricity, magnetism, and gravity, are interrelated. So you can convert one to the other. So they were using electromagnetism to defeat gravity. And when I say they went back to 10,500 BC, that's actually half of the Earth's precession, where the magnetic pole, it would be the opposite from in relation to the spinning pole that it was when the Nazis started out. So perhaps that had something to do with it. In any event, they appear to have gotten stuck there. And there was those ancient Indian texts talk about a war between the Vamanas, and they probably destroyed all the evidence. So it didn't really disrupt our timeline at all. It's an interesting speculation. Makes you wonder why fascism has been so prevalent all throughout history. H. Beam Piper actually wrote some science fiction similar to these lines called Paratime, where they people were looting the entire timeline. But in addition, another author, I guess he did Roswell in the Third Reich, the book, he was saying that the supposed aliens at Roswell were... actually humans that were suffering from progeria, which is a form of rapid aging. As the pilots of the UFO, there were signs that plants and people that were developing it died from old age from the effects of the field. So the time dilation is a very strange effect. And if aliens do the same thing, they're probably affected as well. That's why we're not overrun with aliens, because there are drawbacks to the technology. Probably send out probes or something. And the Nazis may have been influenced by alien action. I do notice that fascism tends to concentrate wealth up into fewer hands, which makes it much easier just to pick it off and collect it if you want to move it somewhere else, like another planet. I wanted to go into this more, but it looks like I'm running a little late. So that's the show for tonight. Thank you for listening.
If you look at Colonel Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, in one of the passages in which he is attempting to describe what he thought was the physics of this device, it, number one, dealt with plasmas, and number two, it dealt with magnetic fields in rotation that were separated. Richter himself is one of the scientists that very clearly, as I indicate in Roswell and the Reich, was connected to the Bell Project simply because of the nature of the plasma research he was doing for the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, which was the German company that built the actual Bell device itself. And that's the company that provided Richter all of his equipment in Argentina.